From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
You can build this party as you join it and participate in it. You can build this party as a fresh green plant, pushing up between the two fossil parties that have no grassroots base at all.
Today, a conversation with Green presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Also, the Reverend Al Sharpton will discuss the recent alleged lynching of a black teen in Mississippi and the security guard who possibly choked to death a black man in Michigan. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Clinton administration is planning to postpone the first federal execution in nearly 40 years because of the absence of clemency procedures and concerns about racial and geographic disparities in death penalty cases. This, according to administration officials. The White House is awaiting Justice Department regulations for death row prisoners to follow in seeking clemency from the president. Juan Raul Garza, who was convicted 7 years ago of three drug-related murders, is scheduled to be executed on August 5th, and his lawyer said they will use the new procedures as soon as they have them to ask President Clinton to spare Garza's life. Data gathered so far by the Justice Department shows that members of minorities make up more than three-quarters of the defendants in federal capital cases, and that federal prosecutors in five districts, including two in New York, have filed nearly half of the federal cases in which the death penalty was an option. Going back to 1988, the Attorney General has authorized the death penalty against 199 defendants. Three-fourths of these defendants have been members of minority groups, with 103 of them African Americans. For the years 1995 through 1998, United States attorneys submitted 471 death penalty cases to the Justice Department for review. Slightly more than 200 were from five judicial districts. Puerto Rico was at the top. Pervasive crime and corruption are blocking the success of the Dayton Peace Accord in Bosnia, and the Clinton administration should consider suspending its extensive aid until local authorities show a determination to fight such abuses. This according to the General Accounting Office. The report by the investigative arm of Congress found that the failure of local authorities to curb graft, organized crime, and other abuses could interfere with the eventual withdrawal of American and other NATO troops. According to a draft copy of the report obtained by the New York Times, top American and international officials asserted that, quote, there's been no measurable progress in reducing crime and corruption in the 4 years since the end of the war. And the Yugoslav parliament approved constitutional changes yesterday that could let Slobodan Milosevic, the Yugoslav president, rule for up to 8 more years. The amended constitution will allow Milosevic to seek a new term in office through a popular ballot when his term expires next year. When Vice President Gore attacked Citizens for Better Medicare this week for, quote, polluting the airwaves with ads opposing the Democrats' prescription drug plan, he left out one important fact. His own top message advisor once sought to run the pharmaceutical industry's ad campaign. Carter Eskew unsuccessfully made a pitch to the pharmaceutical industry in mid-1999 to handle the lucrative advertising and public relations account now being run through Citizens for Better Medicare, an industry-funded group. A short time later, Eskew left the public relations firm BSMG Worldwide to join Gore's campaign as chief media advisor and message shaper. This news from Sacramento, a bill to limit California's virtually unrestricted campaign contributions won approval in the legislature yesterday. The Assembly passed the bill and sent it to California Governor Gray Davis. The Senate approved it Wednesday. If Davis signs it, the proposal will go before voters in November. The measure would limit donations to campaigns for statewide offices and the legislature. The limits would not apply to federal offices. Organizers of protests aimed at disrupting the Republican and Democratic Party conventions this summer promised yesterday to put thousands of people on the streets to demand a seismic shift in American politics. Those planning the protests in Philadelphia and Los Angeles told a news conference they hope to rival the demonstrations last year in Seattle, where 50,000 people curtailed international trade talks and brought the city to a standstill. And Kenneth Starr's former spokesperson faces trial next week in a battle over news leaks during the Monica Lewinsky investigation that until now was fought mostly in secret. The criminal contempt trial of Charles Barkley, who is being prosecuted by the government, is to begin on Thursday. And the Justice Department agreed yesterday to pay $355,000 in legal fees to settle a lawsuit brought by defense lawyers and a whistleblower for release of documents from its investigation of the FBI crime lab. More than 53,000 pages of documents from the department's internal investigation of the world-renowned FBI lab will be posted on the internet for the public to read and defense lawyers to comb for possible evidence of government errors that might benefit their clients.
There's a former Red Eye radio. I'm out of trouble. I'm for the little guy. Blue, black, tan, gray, green, red, white. I'm for the guy that lost the fight that day on the schoolyard when the bully stole the nerd's hat. And the nerd let him have it. The hat, that is. And it wasn't right. Demanded fight. So the little guy, nobody, stepped forward and said, hey, you can't do things like that. And the bully laughed, oh yeah? Watch this. And pushed little guy nobody's face into the chain link fence. Massaged it there while the nerd looked on mewling. It's only a hat. It's only a hat. To the little guy nobody had had enough of being a hero. Feeling the knots of the chain link fence cut into his cheeks.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And we've got some very important guests today on Democracy Now!
That's right. The first half of the show, we're going to be speaking with Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. And at the second half of the show, the Reverend Al Sharpton will be joining us to talk about some major cases over the last week, what's believed to be a possible lynching that took place of a black teen in Mississippi, and also the choking death of a black man in a Michigan shopping mall by a security guard. And that's a story that hits close to home for us because our own technical director, Errol Maitland, who is still out recovering from a police attack on him when he was covering the Patrick Dorismond funeral, a Haitian who was killed, a Haitian-American killed by police in New York. Errol's own son was killed by security guards at a Best Buy department store in South Carolina. But right now, we're going to turn to Ralph Nader. It's very interesting today, Juan. The Washington Post has a front-page piece saying that Al Gore's presidential campaign is brushing aside concerns from the Democratic Party's so-called liberal wing to write a platform affirming centrist stands on trade, education reform, debt reduction, and foreign intervention. Under the proposed platform to be unveiled today, Democrats would affirm the vice president's support of free trade, lifting language from a New York speech declaring that, quote, free and fair trade can help create high-paying jobs for America. That's language that both in content and in tone is deeply opposed by major industrial unions. The Washington Post goes on to say Gore's operatives from the campaign and within the Democratic National Committee have taken firm control of the platform writing process and are determined to keep the party moving in the same direction. While the exact wording is yet to be determined, officials say the platform would defy key liberal interest groups on several controversial matters beyond trade and education policy. The platform, for instance, will follow Gore's stump speech on fiscal responsibility and reject efforts by many advocacy groups to use the growing budget surplus for a major injection of money into existing and new programs. Gore has called for a $500 billion 10-year tax cut and a new prescription drug program, but he also calls for using other surplus funds on debt reduction. Party officials said the platform will offer continued support for the death penalty. Well, Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader called this week for Democratic and Republican leaders to support efforts to provide the public easier access to voting records. In a letter he wrote to the vice president, Nader called for placing a searchable database of congressional votes on the Internet. And we're going to talk with him about this and other issues. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Juan?
Well, Ralph, I'd like to begin. So, there have been some articles that have been coming out lately that say that Gore is already responding to your candidacy in his stump speeches by attempting to appear more populist. But here we have the platform apparently being written in another direction. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I think what we're seeing is a replay of Clinton in 92 with Gore mouthing some critical comments against oil industry gouging on gasoline prices and drug industry gouging on drug prices. It's all talk. It doesn't mean anything. And people here in Washington know it's all talk.
Can you talk about the Internet and talk about what your proposals are?
Yes. You know, when there's an old saying, when all is said and done, more is said than done. And Al Gore incessantly talks about connecting the country, the schools, other institutions with the Internet. He's a gee whiz person who talks about Silicon Valley with a kind of awed reverence. So I decided to put his feet to the fire on this, and I sent a letter to Al Gore and George W. Bush and the leadership of the House and Senate of both parties and said, every member of Congress has a website, and no member of Congress, to my knowledge, puts on their website their voting records in a classifiable, understandable, retrievable way. In fact, all you see on these websites are the carefully channeled propaganda of the senators and representatives controlling the flow of information to the folks back home. And so I asked all the presidential candidates and the Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and Senate to join together and out of this presidential campaign produce a collateral benefit other than just a winner and urge Congress and urge every member of Congress to put their voting records on their website. That means back home, people, whether for civic purposes, press purposes, scholarship purposes, can tap into their computer and find out exactly what these members of Congress are doing in contrast to what they're saying they're doing. And thus far, no answer. And I don't expect an answer from any of these people. They're not interested in using technology for democratic purposes. They're just interested in subsidizing technology, like huge research and development credits to vastly profitable technology companies such as Microsoft, and further drain the federal treasury.
Saying that not a single member of Congress, not even the couple who call themselves independents, responded to your letter?
Well, it's a little too early for members of Congress to respond, but it wasn't early for the campaign headquarters of Bush and Gore to respond. Now, Congressman Christopher Shays from Fairfield County in Connecticut, he will send you his voting record in a newsletter, and he'll break it down, you know, environment, defense, etc. But there are only about three members of Congress that do that. I mean, this is an astonishing gap. If there's any information, it should be on a congressional website. That should be it. And it isn't just floor votes. It's subcommittee votes. It's committee votes.
Ralph, one of the big issues, obviously, that Al Gore has been raising is the whole question of a prescription drug plan. There's a report by Public Citizen that's come out this week that says that the political donations by the drug industry has sharply risen, and from 1997 to 1999, the industry spent $235 million on lobbying at the federal level. Do you think... obviously, most of the giving is to the Republican candidates, but what do you expect to be the impact of the pharmaceutical industry as the nation debates this whole question of a prescription drug plan?
It's just the buying of the U.S. government. The drug companies played the usual game of funneling money into both party coffers. Look what they get in return. Runaway drug prices that are gouging, especially the elderly. Drug prices that are higher than any country in the world. In some drugs, double the price of Canada's drug prices. These are the same drugs by the same U.S. drug companies. And to top it off, they're getting billions of dollars, as reported in the New York Times recently, in federal tax subsidies, not only in terms of regular tax subsidies, you know, the various loopholes that we're all accustomed to now for corporations, but a huge flow of already discovered and developed and tested medicines through the National Institutes of Health, which are given away free to selected drug companies, like Taxol, the anti-cancer drug, was given away free to Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is now grossing over $1 billion a year on a drug that cost a patient anywhere from $14,000 to $16,000 for a series of treatments. That's what they get for their money. They put a few million dollars in the coffers of presidential campaigns, senatorial and House campaigns, and they get billions of dollars back. That's why Will Rogers, many, many years ago, described Congress as the best money can buy. It's time to put an end to it. And that's what the Green Party agenda and my presidential campaign strives to do. People always say they're fed up and they're sick and tired of corrupt politicians. They're sick and tired of government being captured by these big business lobbies and having government turned against its own people. Well, this is their chance to join this Green Party presidential effort and contact us on VoteNader.com or VoteNader.org, our website, or phone us in Washington, 202-265-4000, or send your contributions or your wishes to volunteer and to organize and to get out the vote right in your neighborhood, in your community, to Nader 2000, P.O. Box 18002, Washington, D.C., 20036. It's time for action. It really is time for action.
Right.
Half of the people in this country don't even vote. We always say this, but how do we develop a political campaign where we appeal to the non-voters, the 75 to 80 million non-voters in presidential elections?
Ralph Nader, your campaign for the presidency is clearly shaking up the establishment. You had one of the harshest editorials there was about you in the New York Times over the July 4th weekend. It began Ralph Nader's long history of public service championing the causes of consumers, the environment, and economic justice automatically commands respect. But in running for president as the nominee of the Green Party, he's engaging in a self-indulgent exercise that will distract voters from the clear-cut choice represented by the major party candidates, Vice President Al Gore and Governor George W. Bush. It says his candidacy will be especially harmful for Mr. Gore, the contender closest to Mr. Nader on the environment and other issues. This political reality casts doubt on Mr. Nader's claim to be driven by policy differences rather than ego. They printed your response on July 4th, perhaps the least read newspaper of the year.
Well, that was a self-demeaning editorial. I know many time reporters were aghast at it. It was internally illogical. On the one hand, they praised my work in these areas, consumer protection, good government, environment. On the other hand, they said that observing, as they do in their own editorials, the corrupt political process that's obstructing the civil society, obstructing citizen groups from having a chance, at least, to prevail or to shape public policy in Congress and the executive branch and the judiciary, having recognized all that, then they say, how dare you enter the political arena and clutter the playing field? They actually used the word clutter the playing field. This is an editorial that basically is establishing the case for a two-party duopoly, having an entitlement against any competitors. Historically, that editorial is rebutted. And in contemporary scene, it is a rebuttal of their own reporters and their own feature writers who have documented time after time the corrupt political process and the excessive abuses of corporate power here in Washington.
Ralph Nader, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we hope you'll stay with us for a few more minutes beyond the break as we talk about a number of issues, including the presidential debates. And is it a done deal that you will be excluded from them? We are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After our conversation with Ralph Nader, we'll be joined by the Reverend Al Sharpton to talk about the recent death of a young Mississippi teen. Was he lynched? And also a security guard's killing of a man, a black man, in a Michigan mall. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
You can build this party as you join it and participate in it. You can build this party as a fresh green plant pushing up between the two fossil parties that have no grassroots base at all. Parties built on business cash, driven by business cash, fueled by business cash, animated by business cash, so that they are more and more remote from the American people and engage mostly in campaigning against one another through 30-second electronic ad combat and exclusive presidential debates.
Green Party candidate for president Ralph Nader, in his acceptance speech at the Denver convention of the Green Party last week. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and Ralph Nader joins us on the telephone. Ralph Nader, at that convention, there were a few people from the Reform Party who were endorsing your presidential candidacy. How are you different from Pat Buchanan?
Well, very, very different. I believe, for example, in repealing restrictive labor laws like Taft-Hartley and enacting laws that facilitate the organization of trade unions. Membership in trade unions in our private economy is the lowest in 60 years. It's under 10%. That explains a lot why 47 million American workers, over one-third of the workforce, makes less than $10 an hour, many of them five and a quarter, six, seven, eight, not a livable wage. I don't see Pat Buchanan talking much about consumer protection, cracking down on the enormous patterns of fraud in the insurance, banking, HMO, automobile areas that are depleting family budgets. I don't see him talking about the structure of corporate power and how we have to have a new concept of making the chartering of corporations an accountable mechanism. He doesn't really talk much about universal health insurance, accessible, with an emphasis on prevention. He doesn't like regulation. He's not really talking much about the tax inequities where the rich and the corporate get away with it, and the middle class has to pay a higher percentage of their of the tax burden. There are a lot of differences. I think he's more against globalization. Period. I think we have to have civic globalization, civic institutions across national boundaries, governments that deal with such issues as global infectious diseases and the military arms trade. So there are really a lot of differences. But, you know, he and I are critical of the sovereignty depleting aspects of WTO and NAFTA, and he's speaking out on that. And maybe having an effect on the Republican Party is certainly part of it.
You know, Ralph, in the same week that the Times blasted your candidacy, they lauded the victory of Vicente Fox in Mexico. Of course, the Fox's victory could only come as a result of a three-party race because he did not get anywhere near a majority of the votes in Mexico. And the first thing he did as the supposed conservative candidate in the race when he won was say that he wants to start renegotiating aspects of NAFTA and also immigration policy. He believes that there's got to be much more labor and environmental protection, and also that it's contradictory for our government to press for reducing the barriers to capital while erecting more and more barriers to labor's across the borders. Your comment about this whole issue of immigration and free trade.
One, I think it's going to be trouble from the new president on this area in Mexico. There's such a thing as reducing tariff barriers and having freer trade between nations. But when you allow $7 a day Mexican truck drivers to cross the border and drive their cars, their trucks anywhere in the 50 states with their cargo, you are having these truck drivers compete against American truck drivers who are making $15, $20, $25 an hour, not $7 a day. That's not only a prescription for violence on the highways. It's an outrage. I just wrote a column, satiric, saying that the New York Times today announced that in order to meet the global competition, it decided to replace its columnists, Tom Friedman and Paul Krugman, with two brilliant bilingual Chinese columnists who worked with the Chinese Beijing Daily newspaper, and that the Mexican Chamber of Commerce chief decided to bid for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce job here in Washington at one-tenth the salary of Tom Donahue. Maybe that'll bring it home. This is international trade run riot. You can't allow this. Let me tell you, would we ever allow one state drive down its wages in order to compete with other states? Why do we allow a neighboring country to do that under NAFTA? And we've really got to come to grips with this. These are politicians who just are completely remote from blue-collar workers. I think the United Auto Workers, United Steel Workers, the Teamsters are right in making themselves scarce to Al Gore and not endorsing him yet, because we have to have a major a debate on this.
Speaking about debates, Ralph Nader, what about how the presidential debates will operate, and is it a done deal that you will be excluded from them?
Well, that's the name of the two-party system. It's exclusion. They exclude third parties with huge electoral ballot hurdles, like huge numbers of signatures and all kinds of harassment to third parties getting their candidates on the ballot, such as in North Carolina or Indiana or Illinois. And the debates are just extension of that, Amy. But I think public opinion is starting to affect the debate commission. An advisor to Gore recently on Crossfire apparently said he would have no objection to one four-way debate. A majority of the people polled want me and Buchanan on the debates, and that's only going to grow. And I think we're going to see more and more public opinion pressure to at least have one of the debates be a four-way debate. I mean, what are the Democrats and Republicans afraid of? Are they afraid of new ideas? Are they afraid of alternative proposals to solve the problems in this country with solutions that are ready to go, that are on the shelf, but are blocked by corporate governmental power? Not only that, I think there are other ways to get debates. If the major Hispanic groups in Southern California got together and in effect summoned the presidential candidates, I don't think Bush and Gore could ignore it, because they're both bidding ferociously for the Hispanic vote. The same is true for blue-collar unions in the Midwest, if they sponsored their own debate. So we got to get around this cul-de-sac of the Republicrat Debate Commission and break its monopoly. It's a disgrace to the pretensions of our democratic society that we allow the major discussion of future presidential policymaking to be monopolized by this debate commission.
Ralph Nader, you recently put in your FEC filing, the Federal Election Commission filing, which indicated you have about $4 million in personal wealth and invest in a number of companies like, for example, Cisco, the Internet company. Can you talk about that?
Yes. You have to have resources to fight these big business lobbyists. And the reason why we've been able to do this for 30-some years is we're very prudent in our fundraising, we're very frugal, and we have a reserve. No presidential candidate devotes over 80% of his earnings to civic action projects, to foundations that pursue social justice, to creating new citizen groups, as I have. And that's why money is important. Money is very uninteresting to me. It doesn't mean anything to me other than to support programs in the advancement of justice. And most of the reserve is in money market funds. A few are in technology companies that are relatively neutral compared to other companies that could be invested in.
Although, for example, Cisco has a lot to gain with the opening up of China and in many ways lobbies against positions you lobby for.
Well, that's an interesting point. I have opposed a lot of Cisco and Silicon Valley's policies in recent years, and that's a conflict against financial interests. Perhaps I'm trying to make that point, that those of us who are possessed of these funds should pursue policies frequently that are against our financial interests, because there's a higher and more important issue at stake.
Another issue that maybe a lot of people don't know about you, your background, is that you're a Lebanese American. And I was wondering how that shapes your view of foreign policy. I mean, next week we're going to see a Middle East summit taking place that President Clinton is going to be presiding over. But your take on the Middle East peace process?
Well, it's got to be fostered like any peace process. It's got to recognize issues of justice affecting the Palestinian people. It's got to focus on democratic processes in all these countries in the Middle East. It's got to reflect a foreign policy that doesn't side with dictators and oligarchs, but sides with workers and peasants. It's got to reflect a foreign policy that treats the most fundamental needs of people in terms of land reform, in terms of health care, in terms of education.
What about Iraq sanctions? Where do you stand on the U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq?
End them immediately. This is probably the most contemporary criminal behavior of the United States and the U.N. abroad. 5,000 Iraqi children are dying every month. The dual list embargo bans, for example, child catheters. It bans kidney dialysis machines on the theory that they might be used for military purposes. All the sales of oil by Iraq are put in a U.N. bank account. Everything is expended under U.N. control. If the purpose of these sanctions is to destabilize Iraq's dictator, it's doing just the opposite. The way you give a dictator more repressive powers is to attack innocent people in the dictator's country, which is what the sanctions do.
And finally, your view on the death penalty. All the other candidates, as far as I know, who are running are in favor of it. What's your perspective on the death penalty?
Since I was a law student in the 1950s at Harvard Law School, it does not deter. It is implemented in a way that's extremely discriminatory, especially against poor and minorities. It has to be a perfect system and not execute one innocent person, and that's nothing that can be substantiated. It also involves almost a destruction of any sense of criminal defense. These people are not given adequate lawyers. They're not given automatic DNA tests. They are exposed to basically a powerful prosecution, oftentimes without adequate defense, without adequate reporting. And for those who are interested, it's cheaper to put somebody in jail for life without parole than to pursue a capital crimes case with an execution. as its objective.
Ralph Nader, on the issue of the death penalty, when Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham, was executed in Texas that day and those days leading up to it, there was a lot of press attention, tremendous activism around the country to stop his execution. The case, based on the testimony of one eyewitness, other eyewitnesses in the murder trial were not brought forward by a very incompetent defense that he had. George Bush, of course, presided over the execution, has presided over more executions than any governor in U.S. history. When Al Gore was asked about the case that day, he said he's for the death penalty. Well, you say you're against the death penalty. What about taking a proactive stance? Many criticize you for not, for example, going to Huntsville, to making this a major part of your platform and bringing in people of color into your campaign, being more inclusive, these kinds of issues, bringing in more people, since a disproportionate number of people on death row and in prisons are Black and Latino.
Well, no other presidential candidate has taken a stand against the death penalty. I want to distinguish that we need to focus on corporate charters and criminally behaving corporations and pull their charter. That's called often the corporate death penalty. We have an extremely detailed platform to deal with urban and rural poverty and to start enforcing the law against the rapacious and predatory impacts, whether it's lending or health, lack of health care or other brutalization of poor and minority peoples in the country. I've campaigned in 50 states, Amy, since March 1st. You can't be in 10 places at once, unless you're a corporation, that is. We are going to emphasize very much the issues of poverty, that there's 20-plus percent child poverty in this country, highest by far in the Western world at a time of 10 years of economic growth. And by the way, in California, child poverty was 15% in 1980. California's economy has been booming. You know what it is today? 25.2% child poverty. And that's real poverty. That's not just some theoretical construct by the Department of Labor.
To go back to foreign policy, the U.S. involvement in the war in Yugoslavia and these so-called humanitarian interventions that our nation, along with NATO and other chosen allies, gets involved in, what's your stand on that, on these interventions?
They tend to be botched when you don't have preventive diplomacy, preventive defense, and when you don't act properly early enough. Then you get all kinds of complications, slapdash interventions, untrained troops, conflict between different troops speaking different languages. What we need is to declare as a foreign policy that nonviolence is the top priority, and we define violence not just in terms of preventing war, but in actively waging peace. And that means that we spend resources on waging peace. We use some of these intelligence agencies' budget for anticipating these kinds of conflicts, such as between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which is a completely preventable, hugely bloodshed war. And that means having a multilateral peace force, not dominated by the U.S., well-trained ahead of any of the conflicts, well-trained and ready by certain criteria to prevent such slaughters as 600,000 Rwandans or the slaughter in Yugoslavia. Obviously, this requires very, very careful international cooperation. But we've got to do it in a much more deliberate, far-sighted, preventive manner than at the present time. And we shouldn't dominate it.
I want to end by going back to that issue that people are talking about around the country who would support you, but concerned about what it would mean in the race between Gore and Bush. What is your response to that?
Well, if you're really pleasantly responding to the Democrat and Republican record over the years, you're free to vote for them. But if you stay home and you don't vote, as a half of the people don't, out of revulsion, or a feeling that their vote doesn't count, doesn't matter, go for a new political party that emphasizes clean politics, gets rid of dirty money in campaigns, and fosters in many dimensional manners clean communities and healthy environments and healthy people. That's what you have. You have your choice now. I get a little tired of hearing all over the country ordinary folks bitterly complaining about their government. And then when they have a chance to start a new progressive political movement, they say, no, one party's not quite as bad as the other, Democrat, Republican. We got to go with the least of the worst. When you go with the least of the worst, you're giving your vote to a downward pattern of two-party politics that are becoming more and more alike and more resistant to any kind of Democratic small-d accountability. So you've got your choice, and I don't think non-voters have any excuses anymore. If they're looking for a clean, progressive political movement that they can help build, they've got one in the Green Party presidential candidacies at the local, state, and national level. And I might add again, if you want to log into our website, it's votenator.org or votenator.com, and let's hear from you. And if you want us on the debates, let's hear from you. We'll multiply your input to break through this gated political community called the Republicrat two-party duopoly, essentially one corporate party with two heads wearing different makeup. The country deserves better.
Ralph Nader, Green Party candidate for president. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. On June 15th in Kokomo, Mississippi, a black teenager was found hanging from a pecan tree in his front yard. Investigators tried to rule it a suicide, but community leaders suggest that 17-year-old Rainer Johnson was killed because he had dated two white girls. And some are comparing his death to the 1955 lynching of Emmett Till, murdered for whistling at a white woman. Reverend Jesse Jackson has called for a federal investigation in this most recent case and is planning a march this weekend in Mississippi to draw attention to the killing. Meanwhile, in Michigan, a private security guard was charged yesterday with involuntary manslaughter in the choking death of a black man last month outside a department store. The charge against Dennis Richardson, a guard for Lord & Taylor's at Fairlane Town Center in Dearborn, Michigan, came a day after 10,000 protesters rallied outside the store. They maintain that the June 22nd death of Frederick Finley has racial overtones. We hope to be joined by Reverend Al Sharpton in a minute. We are on the line right now with Charles Tisdale, publisher of the Jackson Advocate, a black weekly newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Tisdale.
Good morning.
Can you tell us?
I know Juan Gonzalez, too.
Yes, Mr. Tisdale. I haven't spoken to you since I was down there and earlier this year, yes.
And it's gotten worse.
Well, tell us about this death of the black teenager, Rainer Johnson. What exactly happened that you've been able to reconstruct at this point?
Well, the Johnson killing, hanging, is just a part of a series. A few people remember that in 1992, we had a series of hearings conducted by a victim of one of the hangings I think everybody remembers the hangings in 1964 when Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner were hanged. Well, a new series of hangings in the jailhouses in Mississippi started, and a series of 46 hangings took place, including the son of the NAACP president in Jackson, Esther Quinn, who's a Quinn now, she was a Jones at the time. And in fact, Miss Jones Quinn and her husband, Charles Quinn, are in New York right now trying to stir up support for a trial for the people who hanged young Jones. They have been in New York for about a month now, and they've called on people like Ramsey Clark and others who they feel may be able to add new impetus, as the case was dismissed by a circuit judge here in Jackson, Mississippi. And it has continued. 46 young black men hung in jails in Mississippi. There's a lot of them. And the Jones killing, the body was found hung 9 feet from the floor without any supporting way to get the body up to the 9 feet that he was hanged from. An independent autopsy conducted by a Chicago physician, a pathologist, claims that it could not have been done. Also, the former chief pathologist for the state of Mississippi, Dr. Lloyd E. White, now a professor of pathology at the University of Texas at Austin, claims that the head of the Mississippi Highway Patrol, Jim Ingram, who was also a famous FBI man and in charge of the COINTEL program directed against African Americans in the J. Edgar Hoover administration, also had complicity in the murder of the Jones young man.
But Mr. Tisdale, in terms of this latest killing or this latest death, what is the evidence that suggests that it was actually a killing?
Well, the principal evidence is the fact that the young man's keys were found in a car adjoining the tree, the car keys, the keys to his car, and the fact that there were throat marks, you know, in the same way that in the case of another person who was hung up in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the throat marks were incongruent with what the Dr. Hain, who was the pathologist and who was fired from the Mississippi, as Mississippi pathologist because of inconsistencies between what he claimed were the marks on the throat and the actual marks performed by two other pathologists, one from Chicago and one from Georgia.
Charles Tisdale, publisher of the Jackson Advocate. We're also joined by the Reverend Al Sharpton, who is president of the National Action Network. Reverend Sharpton, you were in Kokomo, Mississippi, and are looking at that case as well as another, which we'll talk about in a minute. What did you find when you were in Mississippi?
Basically, I agree with Mr. Tisdale. I think that clearly the evidence is there. We met with some of the people from Kokomo. We never actually got into Kokomo. We are going to go in next week with a town hall meeting. But clearly the fact of where the keys were found, even the size of the tree, and the general information acquired from the family, along with what I think Mr. Tisdale has laid out, the historic pattern that has gone uncovered until this case, clearly indicates to me that there's something very suspect about this that clearly does not seem at all like a suicide. And there's clearly a pattern of racial violence that is going on in Mississippi under a curtain of silence until this point. So I absolutely support the efforts of the Johnson family and in the broader community in terms of seeking justice, not only for Raina Johnson, but for a litany of cases that Charles Tisdale has been talking about for a long time.
Reverend Sharpton, what about the situation in Michigan? Could you talk about that and what's happened there? And you were part of a protest there as well?
Yes. In Michigan, a man went shopping with his family in a Lord & Taylor store at the Fairlane Mall. This mall has been cited for years as having discriminatory practices toward people of color shopping there. The Detroit branch of the NAACP had even called a boycott of that mall at one point. This person was shopping. He bought several hundred dollars worth of items that day. We have the receipts dated that day. When he came out of the store, he turned around and his 11-year-old daughter was being chased by security guards who said she took a $4 bracelet. When he turned around and came back to them and said, wait a minute, I've just spent hundreds of dollars here. What's the problem? Maybe there's some misunderstanding. Maybe there's some confusion. He had even applied for a Lord & Taylor credit card that day. They got into a fight with him and literally choked him to death. According to their coroner, he died as a result of being strangled to death. And immediately, our chapter of the National Action Network, the Michigan chapter under Reverend Horace Sheffield, along with Dr. Claude Young, who's the national chairman of the board of SCLC, came and met with the family. The family got attorney Jeffrey Feiger. Our position was, even if the young girl at 11 was shoplifting, security guards do not have the right to become the judge, jury, and executioners. The amount of time, the amount of minutes it takes to strangle somebody to death, it is unthinkable in the 21st century. We're talking about a man being choked to death by security guards in the parking lot of Lord & Taylor's in broad daylight. So we called for a rally 2 days ago, and on Wednesday, well over 10,000 people joined us in that parking lot. On yesterday, they did arrest one of the security guards and charge him with manslaughter. But we want both of them, and we want the Justice Department to come in and deal with the practice and pattern and civil rights violation of the Fairlane Mall. So on July 17th, we will be back in Detroit for a rally in front of the federal district court there. And as you probably know, August 26th, we've called a national march commemorating the I Have a Dream March on Washington 63 that we're calling Redeem the Dream. And at that march, we're going to deal with racial profiling nationwide, from the Mississippi case to the case in Dearborn, Michigan, to the fact that we still are sitting here without the federal government dealing with the Amadou Diallo case in New York, with no response to the Patrick Dorisman case, with no federal response to Taisha Miller. We all over this country are seeing law enforcement and racial profiling cases at large, yet we are hearing about a national election and no one that is running nor no one that is incumbent are addressing the matters of racial profiling and racial violence. So we need to go back to Washington and lay this on the lap of the national government. The audacity of people to talk about our voting for them while people are being killed and they can't even find words to discuss it, less known policies to put in place to preserve human life in our communities.
Well, Reverend Sharpton, I wanted precisely to ask you about the presidential race and whether this is going to become an issue in the campaign. There's been very little from either the candidates, the main candidates in the Republican and the Democratic Party, to this issue. How do you expect that, or do you have any hopes that this can become a major issue in this campaign?
One of the reasons that we're reenacting this march is a lot of people have romanticized the first march. John Kennedy didn't want to talk about race. It was the 63 march. It was Birmingham. It was movements that forced the Kennedys and then subsequently Lyndon Johnson to deal with racial violence and racism and discrimination. So we ought not think that those historians that try to rewrite history, that the Kennedys and the Johnsons were just progressive guys that just wanted to solve this problem, are telling the truth. The way we're going to make this an issue in this election is the way they did it 37 to 40 years ago, and that is by mobilizing and forcing the issue. When 10,000 people go in the parking lot in Dearborn, Michigan, when thousands go to Washington August 26th, they will have to deal with it, because we must make it clear to not only Bush but also to Gore that if you are not addressing the issues that are most central to us, like our very lives, then we don't intend to vote for anyone that is too afraid, timid, or trying to play politics with the right wing that they can't address situations like this.
Reverend Sharpton, what do you think of Ralph Nader's candidacy? We just did an interview with him in the first half of today's program.
I think Ralph Nader has been very progressive on issues. I'd like to hear him say more about what's going on in terms of race and police brutality. But at this point, I think that he's heads and shoulders above the other two candidates on most issues.
Let's talk for a minute about what happened last week in Huntsville, Texas. You were there. Gary Graham, now known or who was known as Shaka Sankofa before he was executed. You were one of only a few people who actually witnessed the execution. Can you describe what that was like?
Well, you know, I've been in morgues with parents of police brutality victims and racial violence, and I have seen them have to identify the dead bodies of their children. But nothing was more traumatic to me than to stand in what was probably a 5x7, 6x9 chamber and watch a man killed by the state, who I believe was innocent of the crime that he was being killed for, and in his last breaths continued to challenge us and challenge others through us to fight to stop the unfair use of the death penalty and to stop state murder and state prosecution. Gary Graham, we had hoped to the last minute, would have been spared. Clearly, for a man to be executed based on the testimony of one fleeting eyewitness, to have insufficient legal defense, his lawyer, who was black, by the way, literally slept through the case, never called six witnesses that were either eyewitnesses that could have saved him or alibi witnesses that could have placed him elsewhere, never cross-examined the one eyewitness that identified him. For this man to go to death with that kind of flimsy evidence means that all of us are one witness away from the death chamber, as far as I'm concerned. So when Bianca Jagger and Reverend Jesse Jackson and Minister Robert Muhammad and I were the four that Shaka Sankofa had requested to be the witnesses, when we were brought into the building, we were expecting at 6 o'clock an execution. When the time went past 7, we thought maybe the Supreme Court had done the right thing and stopped it, because inside we have no information. The people outside were having much more information than we did. By 8 o'clock, I was almost sure that the execution had been stopped by the Supreme Court with a stay. And then a little after 8, the guards came in and said, be ready to go down in 5 minutes. The Supreme Court voted 5-4 not to stay the execution. And one of the deciding votes was Clarence Thomas, which was a real spit in the face of those that made a Clarence Thomas possible in the first place. And then when we brought down to this little cell, you're standing there, you're looking through a glass partition, and he's laying there handcuffed and strapped down to a gurney, head even strapped down. And despite all of that, his last words was challenging us on social policy, challenging us on the death penalty, and reiterating his innocence. And in the midst of making his statement, his eyes rolled back and he's dead. I think that the Bush administration in Texas clearly, who's not only did nothing to stop it, but in fact supported it, has to be dealt with. But I also think the silence of Al Gore has been deafening on this. And I think that clearly, not only racial profiling, but the death penalty ought to be issues that we make front and center,
Reverend,
in these first national elections.
Reverend Sharpton, we want to thank you for being with us, as well as Charles Tisdale of the Jackson Advocate. We have to wrap up the program and wish a very fond farewell to our producer, David Love, who heads off to law school as a public service scholar. Dave's been our scholar in residence for the past 16 months, researching issues from the bombing of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in 1921 to the Gary Graham execution to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, reparations. And we'll never forget the image of David covering the battle in Seattle, choked up with tear gas, pulling together headlines, eyes reddened with lack of sleep and pepper spray. Well, we look forward, Dave, to your op-ed pieces for the Progressive Media Project, which appear around the country, and your responsibilities, which you probably didn't even know you had as an officer in the Democracy Now! Alumni Association, the DNA Association. Well, God, Dave, we're going to miss you very much, and all the very, very best. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Nell Geiser helped with today's program. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I wanna wish you sunlight through the clouds.